You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
What a wonderful panel we have here. I'm really looking forward to what they have to say. I think I have some good questions for them. As our practice, we'll start out with opening statements, and then I'll follow that up with some questions. So right here on my right, doesn't seem right, does it? But Roberto Rodriguez, I've been working with the administration for the last, say, 5 or 6 weeks to plan this event and discuss preschool, and it's pretty obvious to me that Roberto from the White House is coordinating things from the White House, so he's playing a very important role in this. We're really glad to have him here to give us sort of the inside scoop and defend the administration against all these other panelists who will be attacking viciously his program. So we'll look forward to that. And then all the way down at the end, on the far right, as it were, is Russ Whitehurst. Russ is a person I mentioned in the beginning and started the Institute for Education Sciences and did a magnificent job. National Academy of Sciences once said that we knew nothing about education interventions. That's probably 15 years ago. But thanks to Russ and now this administration, we have lots of random assignment studies. We have lots of evidence. Very good. And Russ knows a lot about preschool as well. Jenny Owen from Duke University. It's so hard for me to say something from Duke. We couldn't get anybody from UNC, so we settled for someone from Duke. And Jenny heads an organization at Duke called the Center for Child and Family Policy. So that's a good name for an organization, right? That's, in case you hadn't noticed, that's our name, too. We copied them. And then Steve Barnett from Rutgers. And Steve has played a major role in many preschool programs, but especially for those of you who may know, he runs the Institute for Early Education Research, and every year they put out a volume called The State of Preschool. They didn't have enough money to print it this year, but it's available on their website. It is the Bible of preschool in the United States. It has fantastic information. If he didn't do it, nobody would. It would take you 3 days to figure out how many states have what kind of standards, and now you can do it in 3 minutes. And then finally, Linda Martin. We're so pleased that Linda could come. She's the Deputy State Director for Economic Services in the state of South Carolina, so she has her department has jurisdiction over the preschool programs. And we felt it was necessary to have a state perspective here. I have some questions for you to try to confuse you in a few minutes. We'll begin with Roberto.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Ron. I want to thank Brookings for the opportunity, and I'm happy to join this esteemed panel today. And I'll try to pick up here where our secretary left off. He really, I think, did an outstanding job of presenting the plan here. We're really excited about the opportunity that we have, particularly for our youngest children, to really take an important step forward as a country in providing the type of high-quality early learning experiences and opportunities that we know are just so essential for their later success in school, for their later success in life, and ultimately for our economic future. I mean, I think when you look at the fact that we rank 28th out of 38 developed nations in terms of access of four-year-olds to high-quality early learning, you begin to really recognize that there is an economic imperative to this work. Certainly our administration comes at this both from the important opportunity that early learning can provide to help our children be well-equipped to succeed in life, but also we know that for our country's future, we have to do better in these early years in providing a high-quality opportunity for all of our children to be able to be successful. So let me unpack briefly the three elements that are part of the president's initiative that he announced as part of the State of the Union and were further illuminated with his budget. You heard Secretary Duncan talk about our Preschool for All initiative. This really is the final piece along a broader continuum of proposed investments here by the president. The first is a piece that was touched on a little bit in this first panel around home visiting. Our administration has been really proud to expand voluntary evidence-based home visitation now across all 50 states to over 200,000 young children and their families. These are opportunities for nurses, for social workers, for parenting educators, for other early educators to really visit at-risk families and provide them the parenting skills, the nutrition, the maternal and child health, and the early learning and cognitive supports that they need to be able to equip their children for success at the earliest point in their life. And there's just such strong research that shows what a difference evidence-based models make in this space. Our administration supports about 12 different models that meet the highest standards of evidence through home visiting. And the president has proposed expanding that program, investing $15 billion through 2023 to expand that program to reach 185,000 additional children and families. We believe that that's one of the most important things we can do, at the earliest time in a child's life, is to provide that opportunity. And we have a whole host of evidence that shows what a difference it makes to cognitive outcomes as well as the social and emotional outcomes that the Secretary talked about. The second piece of this really is proposed investment in a new approach to expand the supply of high-quality care for our infants and toddlers, for our children 0 to 3, through a new Early Head Start child care partnership. So this is a $1.4 billion proposed investment on the discretionary side of the budget. The model here is to really bring the standards that we know make a real difference in the environments in which our infants and toddlers spend time, bring those standards into our child care subsidy system and foster greater partnerships between our Early Head Start providers and between our family child care providers to make sure that the environments in which our infants and toddlers spend time, their child care environments, are of the highest quality, that they're meeting their social and emotional needs, that they're maximizing their opportunities to learn and to develop, because we know what a difference that makes. We have over 1 million children right now, about 1.6 million children in our child care subsidy system. We believe that if we can bring some of these early Head Start standards into that environment and raise the quality, either through across certain states, through networks of providers, in communities particularly that are communities that are in need, we know that we can have a tremendous impact on that third, for instance, that vocabulary gap that you heard mentioned of about 50 points between our more affluent children at age 3 and their less affluent peers. And then finally, of course, is the investment, which we do acknowledge it's a bold, ambitious investment of $75 billion over a 10-year period, really, to expand preschool for all children. And the Secretary talked about this. I just want to underscore the point in particular that our approach to this is not to establish a new permanent silo at the federal level where we will subsume the responsibility on a permanent basis for all of our 4-year-olds in pre-K, but rather to help accelerate the momentum that we have underway across 40 states in beginning to establish state-funded pre-K programs. And what we want to do there is to make sure that we're meeting states where we are, not where they are, not with a one-size-fits-all approach, but with some solid standards that we know will help accelerate enrollment and participation in the state-funded preschool programs, whether those are programs at the community-based level, child care centers or other providers, or whether those are programs that are delivered through our schools. States have a very different mix, and I'm sure you'll hear from Dr. Barnett about the panoply of programs that are out there currently with the states. We believe there's a strong federal role in accelerating the participation in high-quality programs. You heard the Secretary say fewer than 3 out of 10 of our children actually participate in high-quality programs. So we want to provide the opportunity to put ourselves on a path to lead the world. We should be, if we are going to continue to be the world leader economically, we need to be sure we're leading the world in providing the opportunity for our youngest learners to be able to be successful. And certainly all of these opportunities, from home visiting to high-quality child care and infant and toddler care, leading to high-quality pre-K, ultimately leading to a full day of kindergarten, right? Because we have to have that continuum of learning time for our children as they transition into the school system. All of that has to lead into greater focus on quality and on outcomes for our children in the early grades. We have today a situation where at grade three, we have an achievement gap that looms large, and that puts too many of our children at a significant disadvantage if they are not reading at grade level to not be able to graduate. And we're losing a million children a year to the dropout crisis. Really solving that crisis and meeting the president's charge of delivering the opportunity that every child needs to succeed, that has to start early. That has to start in these early years. And so we've made early education and the panoply of investments that I've described here, we've made that a major thrust of our second term agenda. And the president has visited Georgia. He's been around the country, was up in Baltimore just a couple weeks ago now, visiting an early learning program. And he's going to do all he can to work with Congress to see that we make the progress we need on this agenda.
Thank you for that clear statement. Russ Whitehurst.
Thank you. I'm pleased to have the opportunity to talk about this. I've been writing about this some. Some of you will know. And so I want to come at this as best I can from a research perspective. And so let me give you some background. I think what I'll describe here is not in dispute, but is worth having on the table. First fact is that children from low, as Secretary mentioned, children from low-income families, minority families, start school behind. There's a substantial achievement gap, and to date our schools have struggled and not succeeded in closing it. So the differences exist before children come to kindergarten. Preschool programs can have an impact and narrow those achievement gaps, and so starting early with a good preschool education makes a difference. States with the largest proportions of low-income families, who therefore need to do the most to provide more preschool opportunities for children, are also the poorest states and most challenged in having the finances to do that job. The federal government has a long-established role in providing aid for the education of the disadvantaged. It does that in K-12. It's a legitimate role, and I think it's perfectly appropriate to extend that to pre-K. So I'm in favor of a federal program, that dispenses aid to states in a way that's proportional to the number of the low-income families they have, that helps those states provide free or affordable preschool education for kids. For me, there's some issues with the plan the Obama administration has presented. I've written about these things. You can Google Brown Center Chalkboard Whitehurst, and you'll get some of that writing. Examples are the requirement that teachers be paid and credentialed in the same way as K-12 teachers is going to drive up the cost considerably, and there's very little evidence that credentialing has much of an impact on the quality of interactions in the classroom. The Secretary mentioned choice today and letting a variety of service providers be involved. In fact, there's none of the narrative from the administration includes any provision for choice. And there's a requirement that the funds be dispensed by states either to school districts or school districts in partnership with other organizations. And kids are going into school districts that are failing them, and I'm not sure we want school districts to be central to the provision of pre-K services. What I want to talk about today is some data analysis I've been doing in the last week or so that where I'm trying to address the question of what's the likely impact of expanding pre-K for four-year-olds on measurable outcomes? And I want to focus on fourth-grade reading in NAEP. NAEP is a national assessment. It's given to representative samples of children in every state. It is the nation's report card. Teachers can't teach to it. So it's a good outcome. And the first one we have where we can, in terms of a child's development, it allows us to compare performance across states. And I've used the very good data from Barnett's organization on pre-K enrollment to look at variations in state pre-K enrollment in 2006 as they are associated with NAEP scores 5 years later in 2011. And my question is there an association between the level of pre-K participation at the state level and later NAEP scores for that same cohort of kids. And I've done that adjusting for differences among states in their demographics and wealth, because that drives student performance in ways quite independent of the schooling system. There's a great range of pre-K enrollment. It ranges from, in 2006, from zero in 10 states to 70% in Oklahoma. And, of course, there's a great range of performance on NAEP among kids. So the good news for advocates of investment in state pre-K, the correlations are positive and statistically significant. The correlation for the wonks in the audience is about 0.30, which is a good-sized correlation for any kind of education intervention. And the relationships I see in the data make sense, at least to me. So the relationships are stronger for reading than they are for math, and preschools are much more involved in developing the skills that are related to reading than they are in developing skills related to math. So that makes a lot of sense. And the relationships are stronger for the groups that should most benefit from preschool. So they're stronger for Hispanics and other minority groups than they are for whites. They're stronger for children who are eligible for free and reduced price lunch than for affluent kids. So all that makes a lot of sense. The sobering news is that variation among states in NAEP scores is much less than variation among students or classrooms or schools. So existing differences among states in all of their education policies and practices account for a relatively small amount of the differences that exist among students and their achievement outcomes. And you can think about this intuitively. It probably made a lot more difference to you the teacher you had in your classroom than the state in which you lived in terms of what you learned. And that's the intuition I'm capturing with the data. The student standard deviation on NAEP happens to be about 30 points. The state standard deviation on NAEP happens to be about 4 points. And so, in other words, there's not a lot of variation among states, and there's a huge amount of variation among kids. So if we increased a state's performance on NAEP relative to other states by one standard deviation of state differences, that is moving a state from the 50th to the 84th percentile in terms of states, or from the 25th best state to the 8th best state, a huge difference, it would be associated with a 4-point change in NAEP. Not a big difference. I've crunched the numbers with respect to the pre-K enrollment figures I mentioned earlier, to see how they might be associated with changes in NAEP, since pre-K is, of course, only a small portion of the overall state policy and practice that might be related to education. And what do I find? I find a 16% increase in state enrollment in pre-K would predict about a 1-point increase in NAEP 5 years later. That number is bigger if you focus on kids in greater need, but that's the average figure. So what do I conclude from this? There's a positive association between enrollment levels in state pre-K and later academic achievement. That's a good thing if you're an advocate for the expansion of pre-K programs. Should these associations, and they're just correlations, truly reflect a cause and effect relationship, then raising the level of state K pre-K enrollment would certainly enhance academic achievement. However, the impact of very substantial increases in the level of state pre-K enrollment would likely be modest, on the order of magnitude of a few points at most on NAEP in fourth grade. From my perspective, these are impacts worth pursuing, but they fall far short of the impacts that advocates of the expansion of state pre-K have pushed based on generalizations, for example, from the Perry Preschool Project, an intensive program that focused on 70 kids in Ypsilanti, Michigan 50 years ago, that was multi-year, that involved home visiting, that had lots of components that are not part of state pre-K. So we need to be realistic about what we're going to achieve. We need to think carefully about the cost and the benefits and figure out how to minimize the former while maximizing the latter. For me, that means targeting these programs on the kids and population that are going to benefit from them the most. I think we're likely to find a benefit ratio there that is worth pursuing, though certainly not 7-to-1. And I think the politics of this on the Hill require the administration to think less about strings tied to the money and more about providing the money to the communities and states that have the greatest need for it. Thank you.
Thank you, Russ. Jenny Owen.
I'm delighted to be here this afternoon, and as Ron said, I'm here representing Duke, Stanford School of Public Policy and Center for Child and Family Policy, as well as representing APAM. Given the emphasis of the President's proposal on high-quality early childhood education, I wanted to highlight three interrelated priorities to keep in mind. They are alignment of early care and education efforts, which has been addressed already, support for the early childhood education workforce, which I don't believe has been addressed, and implementation. All of these are critical if we're to do a better job making sure all children arrive at kindergarten not just ready to learn, but already learning. And each of these is also influenced, as has come up today, by the broader context in which the President's proposal is emerging. So just a few words first about the broader context. I think there's consensus up here and out there that we know more than ever from rigorous research that early childhood education can make a difference. But we also know that all early childhood education is not created equal. And perhaps more importantly, the implementation of programs to improve early childhood education are not implemented equally. We know, yet rarely sufficiently address, that the early care and education workforce needs more support. And finally, we know, as again has been addressed, that children's preschool years don't exist in isolation from the care and education that come before and after. So I'll speak a little bit first to alignment. They're part of a continuum that starts when a child is born or earlier, preschool education, as the Secretary said. To support the administration's stated goal of, and I quote, a cohesive and well-aligned system of early learning for children from birth to age five, home visiting can play a central role in a preschool for all environment. And I was very happy to hear how many times home visiting has been mentioned today. I wasn't sure that would be the case, and I think that's a great thing. Effective alignment would link to and benefit from home visiting efforts at the federal, state, and local levels, efforts that are identifying and implementing evidence-based and evidence-informed models underway across the country. Home visiting provides a critical platform to build high-quality preschool, which in turn provides a critical platform for entering kindergarten. And I wonder whether we might be able to apply a home visiting model in the preschool environment and perhaps in early school years as well in a way that would make a difference to children beyond the home visiting, the traditional home visiting years. Moreover, a successful alignment would help to alleviate debates faced by numerous states, including mine, about whether to increase pre-K slots at the expense of childcare slots or to do the reverse, which is something many states right now are struggling with. Another priority is workforce support. When considering what's best for all young children, we must remember that the early childhood workforce is in large part the parents of many of the low-resource children that we're talking about today. Research shows that a highly paid childcare assistant, earns somewhere in the neighborhood of $10,000 to $11,000 annually. And some of the highest paid childcare teachers, early childhood teachers, earn somewhere in the neighborhood of $18,000 to $19,000 a year annually. That's under the poverty level for a family of four in the United States. So the early childhood education workforce needs enhanced support, so it in turn can support the kids that we're talking about today again. To give some ideas for what these supports might include, and some of these I think are reflected in the in Steve's recent report in terms of in benchmarks, such supports might include training and professional development opportunities that go beyond the rote requirements of policies and programs, and that reflect the high value we place on early education that we're discussing today. They also might include something like a shared employee assistance program that I imagine many of us working in for-profit, nonprofit, and public entities can benefit from if we have struggles in our own families and our workplaces and so on. I'm not aware of anything quite like that in most early childhood, childcare, and preschool settings. As Steve's recent annual pre-K report highlights, you'll hear from him in a minute, North Carolina is one of few states that meets all 10 of the quality benchmarks, some of which have relevance for workforce support. But as the implementers in North Carolina will attest, and I really made an effort to talk with some of them recently about this challenge, is these quality components really took time to refine and realize. They required investment in people on the ground, and I think this is something that Mrs. Johnson was speaking to, on the ground in local communities who are doing the work, somehow connecting what happens at the federal level to what happens on the ground. That gets to implementation, the third priority that I would emphasize. Guidance that stems from research evidence often focuses on the why behind the policy change without an equal emphasis on the how of the policy and program implementation. That's not new news, but is there something we can do about that? During and following implementation is often where the most critical gap in the transition from policy to practice occurs. A brilliantly developed program won't succeed if it suffers from careless or incomplete implementation. Moreover, implementation that allows time for mid-course check-ins and corrections is essential to long-term progress. As one state early childhood officer recently said to me, or childhood office director said to me, even the greatest pilot program is the beginning of a long road. So success in a pilot doesn't mean long-term success, doesn't mean universal success, and so on. Implementation science has a lot to offer here, and I'll make Ron happy by mentioning something that comes out of UNC. In particular, I would turn to the work of the National Implementation Research Network based at UNC and the brief it produced for the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services in February, the same month that the president announced this proposal. It focuses not only on what makes evidence-based programs work, but on what makes them successful when they're implemented. Thankfully, and I think hopefully, the president's proposal seeks to balance high standards for early childhood education policy change with flexibility for states to determine the best implementation plan for high-quality programs. President Obama's preschool proposal highlights the challenges of cross-sector interaction and coordination and challenges of applying research and policy in practice. It also presents exciting opportunities for doing this successfully. The three priorities I've highlighted, alignment across early education systems, workforce support and implementation, reflect a need for cooperation among different stakeholders with common goals, as we've heard already today. Early childhood education matters to everyone, to children, to families, to employers, to policymakers, practitioners, to the workforce that depends on it for their own livelihood, and to the products that come out of it, young children, and the schools they go to. For its strikingly universal importance, it's strikingly unsystematized. I believe that this proposal is a test of whether research, policy, and practice can combine forces for the benefit of young children and their families. And we've had some really, I think, exciting and possibilities stressed today that will make that possible. I'll conclude with a note about Mount Everest, which will surprise some of you, maybe all of you. Today's the 60th anniversary of Sir Edmund Hillary's and Tenzing Norgay's ascent of Everest. And I was thinking about that and thinking about how would advances in early childhood education stack up against advances in mountaineering. So they wore wool suits, and I looked to see what they had and what they wore. They wore wool suits. They had 5-pound walkie-talkies each that apparently went two-way, so that's good. As small as the number of Everest ascenters is relative to the number of families who seek quality early childhood education for their children, some of the themes we're discussing today really truly apply to both contexts. Those are access, research, and careful implementation of what evidence says works. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Steve Barnett.
Thank you, Ron. Happy to be here today to talk about what I think is a tremendous opportunity for opportunity. We have some educational problems in the United States. I don't think they're necessarily the problems that people think they are. Actually, for example, I think our public schools perform pretty well overall and have been steadily improving over time. And it's remarkable to me how little the improvements in kids' test scores over the last couple of decades, how little attention is given to that. Because then you might have to say, gee, I wonder why the public schools are getting so much better instead of talking about how terrible they are. I also think that while we talk a lot about the achievement gap, that in many ways that leads us to frame the problem incorrectly. We don't have an achievement gap in the United States. We have an achievement gradient. Right? We have a continuum that links family, human, and economic capital and resources with children's achievement, and it's a lot steeper than it is in many other countries. But there's no sharp cutoff, right? And so it turns out that while kids in poverty have high failure rates and high dropout rates, 1 in 10 middle-income kids will fail a grade and be held back. 1 in 10 middle-income kids will drop out of school. So if you want to solve the school failure problem in the United States and you focus on poor kids, you will miss most of the problem. And I also think it creates a kind of us-them dialogue that is unhelpful politically and unhelpful programmatically. And we have a history of 50 years of targeted programs that I think is a history of 50 years of failure. Why do I say 50 years of failure? Well, so we have a problem. We have some solutions. Part of the solution is high-quality preschool programs. The evidence is quite clear. They can produce substantive gains, and that if those gains are large enough to start with, they can produce persistent gains. And they produce persistent gains far up the economic continuum, right? Not just up to the poverty line or even the low-income line, which, by the way, at this point, 200% of poverty covers 50% of American preschoolers. Right? So preschoolers as a group are not doing particularly well on the income continuum. So you have a problem, you have a solution, and we've been trying for 50 years to do this with a targeted model. And yet today, most low-income kids do not have access to preschool. Most low-income kids do not have access to quality preschool. Now, that's partly because most kids, as the Secretary and Roberto said, most kids don't have access to even a good preschool, right? So about a third of preschool classrooms, based on actual observation, qualify as good or better. Right? But a lot of kids don't go to preschool. So if you look at the percentage of kids enrolled in a good preschool, if your parents have graduate degrees, it's almost a third. If your parents are high school dropouts, it's 1 in 10. Right, so that's exactly backwards under a policy regime for 50 years focused on targeting. Now, targeting doesn't do a very good job of reaching the kids it's supposed to reach. Half the kids in Head Start by the end of the four-year-old year are not poor. So it's not just that they don't serve enough kids. It's also that targeting doesn't work very well, in part because we target by income, and income moves. That's a good thing. But it means it's not a very practical policy for reaching the kids that we want to reach. And then added to that, there's a substantial body of evidence that kids don't just learn from their teachers, they learn from each other, particularly in the areas of language and literacy. So low-income kids actually gain more from programs where they're not the only kids in the program. And if you ask most parents what their preference would be for sending their kids to a preschool program, they would pick a program that was open to all kids and not just a program for poor kids. And that's just as true for poor families as it is for anybody else. If we look around the globe, we don't see, as far as I know of, any examples of countries that adopted targeted programs and have successfully enrolled all the kids that they're targeting. We do see a lot of programs that are universal that pretty much enroll all of the low-income kids. And outside the United States, the benefits of those programs are not as lopsidedly in favor of low-income kids, in part because I think they're higher quality. And you have to have a higher quality program to benefit a kid from a higher income family. Right? So if we have lousy programs, they mostly just help poor kids. And not very much, but at least they help those kids. So to me, the administration's proposal has tremendous number of advantages. It is a systems change proposal. It isn't just about changing programs for four-year-olds. But for programs for four-year-olds, it is insistent that they be high quality, which is where we get a payoff. It is insistent that it be a program that's open at least to 200% of poverty and that incentivizes enrolling all kids, which, again, I think is the right direction in terms of impacts and politics. And it emphasizes full day. And one of the things we haven't talked about are that there are child care benefits. And this is a way of getting benefits to families that you don't have to wait 40 years for. And they're modest, but they're perhaps big enough, certainly for low-income families, to justify the expenditure in the program themselves. And one of the things that the economic analyses do tell us is that even if these programs only produce modest gains for kids and families translate into very large economic benefits proportional to cost. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Steve. Linda Martin.
Well, I'm from South Carolina, and as opposed to most of the folks that you've just listened to, who are kind of looking at things from up here, the aerial view of what child care looks like, I'm looking at it from the ground looking up. And it looks a lot more tangled when you're looking from the ground up. South Carolina is a small state. It's a very rural state. And I'm not supposed to say it's a poor state, but it is. My governor told me to say that we didn't have as much revenue. It's a lot easier just to say we're a poor state because we are. And there isn't nearly enough money in South Carolina to cover the kids who need to be in preschool or to be in child care. We estimate that we cover about 20% of the kids in South Carolina who are eligible for child care services. So 80% of the people who would meet the eligibility requirements, the children, don't get the services that they need. And that's a real problem for us because it's a problem in a number of ways. There's a huge income gap in South Carolina, very large income gap, and there's even more important than that, there's a huge gap in the skills that people need for jobs. So we have most of the jobs available in South Carolina need skilled labor or very skilled labor. Most of the workers in South Carolina have no skills, very low skills. So there's a big mismatch between the kinds of folks we need to raise that tax revenue, so we're not a poor state, and the kinds of folks that we have in South Carolina. And so much of what is wrong, so much of what builds that gap has to do with preschool and with early childhood education. Whenever I get an opportunity in South Carolina, whenever I'm asked to, I work for the Department of Social Services, and I have for a long time. Whenever I get asked to say, what would you do? What's the one thing you would do to make things better in South Carolina? Generally what I say is I would provide enough high-quality child care for everybody who needs it so that instead of having lots and lots of people complain about the number of folks who are on welfare and food stamps in South Carolina, we could allow those same people to take jobs and know that their children are safe, are in an environment where they're getting the skills they need to be competitive. It's a very bad mistake we make when we don't do that. In my agency, I have the child care block grant, and I have the social services block grant. I have the child care licensing responsibilities. I have responsibility for developing curriculum for child care agencies. I have the child care, I have the Head Start collaborative office. I have the child and adult care food programs that provide snacks to child care centers. And I have the summer food program. And it's taken a while, but I've gradually been able to mush all those things together into one division. And I've got one person who's coordinating all that because we have discovered that it matters so much that things not be siloed. When there's not enough money, you need it all in one place. And you need it all available to you so that you can provide it where you get the most bang for the buck, where you get the most out of what you have. And that's what we're trying to do within our agency in South Carolina. I'm extraordinarily pleased that there will be more money available to states, especially states like South Carolina, for child care efforts, for what we need in order to build that workforce that isn't so lopsided on where the jobs are and where the skills are. And my only caution is to please, please think about the view when you're lying down on the ground and you're looking up at the trees and the vines and the leaves and how tangled it looks from the ground up as compared to that aerial view. And please keep it as untangled as possible for those of us on the ground.
Thank you very much, and thank you to the panel for these good opening comments. I'd like to deal with something first that I think we can maybe shed some light on. If I were not a researcher, I would be very confused by the media coverage so far. We get articles by very well-known people like Charles Murray that say that the evidence on preschool is really extremely checkered and that we really shouldn't count on big benefits from this big investment that Obama's going to make. And then we read things a step from NEAR, which doesn't have the circulation of the Wall Street Journal, but that there are all these very good evidence. Steve has done, he didn't mention it, but he's done a meta-analysis that shows pretty substantial impacts going all the way up to kids over 8 years of age. And if they're high-quality programs, you get even bigger impact. So what? Help me resolve this. What could we say to the American public that says either both sides are right and here's the explanation about how they're right or one of them's wrong? What is the real, what have we learned from research about the possibility that if we spend $75 billion, we're going to get a big payback?
Well, can I use the technical term mush?
Yes.
So the more you mush the research together, and it's different studies with different methodologies of different programs, the more you get an answer that's not relevant to any particular program that you might want to consider. So we have, for example, a large-scale national Head Start impact study that found some benefits at the end of the Head Start year, but no benefits that lasted in elementary school. So I think it's better to talk about that research when we're talking about Head Start than the mush together findings. When we're talking about state pre-K and its likely impact, I think we need to look at research on state pre-K and not research on something else. So it's a broad topic, and depending on how you slice and dice it and how you mush it together, you can get a different answer. And the answer is not necessarily the wrong answer, given what's been mushed in, but it may not be the answer that's most relevant to the policy decision that's on the table.
So what is most relevant to a proposal like the one the president is supporting?
Well, I think we have a lot of variation among the states in terms of having state pre-K and participation levels in state pre-K, and I think looking at that, though it remains simply correlational data, is relevant, or I wouldn't have done it as the exercise to help here. So I think looking at state programs widely implemented is probably the best evidence of what we're likely to get if we extend and expand such programs.
Steve, what do you think?
For the most part, I agree with Russ that there is a huge variation. There are state pre-K programs that are not nearly as good as Head Start, and I'm sure they don't even get gains out of the box. And I think on the other side of that, there are programs that are more intent. I mean, New Jersey's program costs about $13,000 per kid, and almost all that money goes into the classroom. So there's a much greater resource focus on educating those kids than in most other programs, and so I think you get bigger outcomes. If we look at the meta-analysis, programs that had a focus on intentional teaching produced bigger cognitive gains. Programs that had a
so you're unmushing
on,
now.
Yeah, so you're unmushing, and you're saying, you know, individualization, one-on-one, small group, that produces bigger gains for kids. These are not shocking, right? That if you put more of your resources into the classroom, focused on educating kids, that you get bigger educational gains. State preschool programs are all over the place in terms. So they're not, and it may well be true. I mean, Head Start is probably more uniform, but I suspect also there's considerable diversity there as well. But so when you look at just increasing quantity of state pre-K, I think you'd get very modest impacts, which is why the emphasis and the administration's proposal on a small number of quality standards I think is important with adequate resources. So it's not so much the credential of the teacher that's important. It's paying the teacher an adequate salary. And as long as you're doing that, you might as well require them to have a decent qualification, right? Because the reason people don't require it is because they don't want to pay for it.
Right.
And I think in New Jersey we have what I think of as a test case. So 70% of the kids in our most disadvantaged cities were in preschool. We were under court order to within 5 years give them high quality preschool. And we can show that the quality went from mediocre to poor to good to excellent over less than a decade. And we got results for kids in terms of increasing.
And how far into the public schools can you show that there are impacts?
Well, we followed them through fifth grade. Right? And I think the meta-analysis suggests that if you get results at fifth grade, they're not going away later. Right? If they go away, they go away pretty rapidly. And they're probably about half what the initial impacts were as a kind of rule of thumb, which means you've got to have really, really big, and we shouldn't kid ourselves, that you can produce really small impacts to begin with and you're going to get something great in the long run. That just doesn't happen.
Jenny, you looked like you were itching to say something.
I think it's another great opportunity to bring up home visiting as an example of, you know, anything doesn't go. And so within some continuum, the administration has decided to invest in home visiting, but it's not get the funds and do whatever you want with it. And I think when we use the phrase pre-K, we could all, however many people are in this room, we could have that many different pictures in our mind of real programs that are pre-K. Without necessarily, or in some cases, having standards attached. So I think part of it is about what counts as pre-K. When you talk about what counts as home visiting, now there are things that count and there are things that don't count. And if you don't count, you don't get the funding. And it seems to me that that's the direction, you know, quality-focused direction is the direction that this is headed in.
And that just to reiterate
let me clarify this, and then you can jump in this and tell us can and wants to. So the way this works is the administration basically hired a think tank, a research firm, Mathematica, to review the literature and determine what program models actually have solid evidence, usually meaning from random assignment studies, that they produce an impact. And now the administration gives away home visiting funds only to states that are going to use the money in these kind of programs. This is not unlike the kind of thing you're talking about, Steve. So, and presumably that's what they'll do with this $15 billion of home visiting. But in preschool, we don't have such a thing. We have a zillion curriculums, right? I mean, you may have your favorite, and I've talked to 15 people who have their own favorites, but we don't play, and we're not discussing putting anything like that. We talk about quality standards, but they are so kind of broad and, you know, so would it work to do this in preschool? Could we do something to develop programs that, if implemented faithfully as the home visiting programs are, that we will have a very high chance that we'll produce serious impacts on kids' development?
Well, let me just interject here as well, Ron, just to clarify our administration's proposal as we continue the conversation. I think it's a really good one to have. I've worked on education policy for a long time. There are vigorous debates on every education policy issue and research on both sides. Our clear read of the research here is that quality matters tremendously. And I think particularly when you parse out results. There are, you know, Steve has done work, but there are hosts of other meta-analyses by the Federal Reserve Bank, by others, that show that the return on high-quality programs is particularly strong. You know, return varies depending on the program you look at, $3, $7, beyond. But quality matters greatly, and this has been a driving principle for the development of our own proposal. I mean, I think it's helpful, and I appreciate Russ's sentiment of support for pre-K, and particularly his contribution to the work here from a research perspective. I do think we need to look at the correlation, not just of the current state of our state pre-K programs. To the NAEP, but actually correlation of high quality early childhood. And again, the majority of states out there are delivering pre-K, but many of those states are not delivering the level of quality pre-K that we know returns on investment. So we've said we want to be a partner in that as a federal government. We want to ask you when you come in to do three things: to show that you have quality standards and some level of early learning standards, to show that you have some level of state staff qualifications, and to show that you have some ability to link your preschool system and data system to the broader K-12 system. Beyond that, moving forward, we want to ask you to do some pretty specific things with respect to the federal investment that would be made. And that is to make sure that you have staff ratios that are going to be adequate to make sure you're getting a high-quality environment for children. Make sure you're delivering a full day of service. Make sure that you're compensating your pre-K workforce at an adequate level comparable to the early grades in your schools, in your school districts. To make sure that you're implementing an evidence-based pre-K curriculum. And again, we're not going to make that determination, but there are plenty of folks out there that have looked at the curricula across these programs and know what is real teaching and learning from what is babysitting in certain perspectives. To make sure that we're doing more to provide comprehensive levels of services for our low-income children in pre-K, right? Because we know that the vision, the health, the screening, the social and emotional investments matter greatly as well, and contribute to learning. And there, you know, several other standards on top of that. Those are the types of standards we'd ask states to implement moving forward with our investment, and we'd provide a set aside of our investment to states to improve the quality of their existing slots, of their existing programs that are currently reaching children.
So let me broaden the question then from one of, we're going to say you, there are eight curriculums and you have to use one of those, to something much broader, which is all the requirements that you're putting in order to get the money, state standards, standards for teachers, and so forth. Will that work? Is that going to increase the average quality of child care? First, audience, I think there's no question every study that's ever been done shows this huge range of quality. And I would say the most reasonable interpretation of the National Head Start findings that Russ summarized so nicely is that the programs are just incredibly diverse. Some of them are probably very good and others aren't, and they wash out on average. So it's hard to bring up a whole network of programs throughout the whole country. Is what the administration's proposing going to do it?
Well, New Jersey did it, right, in with 50,000 kids under court order. And I think that you talked about implementation. Right? There is a lot that we don't know. The things that are in the administration's plan, I think, are probably necessary, but not sufficient. And that's why the coaching piece of this, right? So they didn't forget about it has to be well implemented. That's really important. And having a continuous improvement system in place, which we did in New Jersey, where you track the quality. Is it getting better year by year? Is it getting better in language and literacy, in math, in science, not just in one particular area? Are we supporting children's social and emotional development? And personally, I'm not against tracking the kids' test scores at kindergarten entry as a way to keep not testing every kid, right, but tracking how our system is performing based on children's performance on standardized assessments as part of it, and using that information together with the rest of the information to figure out what do we need to do to make sure it really is quality and we're not just having high standards and spending money.
So we spend $75 billion, and you're feeling we're moving in the right direction. This is the right thing to do, but it's not enough yet. You agree with that, Russ and Jenny?
Well, look, I've developed a high degree of caution and skepticism about evidence, about efforts from Washington to take what people think is known from science and drive that into program implementation around the country. We saw that famously with a No Child Left Behind program called Reading First that was, I think, best based on the best evidence at the time on what children needed to get ready to read, and had, so far as we could determine, no positive impact on reading achievement at fourth grade. Now, I'd be much more comfortable here that we would get where we all want to go if what the federal government would do is not provide 10 things the states have to do to get this money, but rather require states, if they accept the money, to carefully monitor progress and demonstrate that kids are showing up in kindergarten and first and second grade in much better shape than they were prior to the receipt of the money, and provide all the technical assistance that that is possible to help states to help themselves to do a better job. I think that's politically viable and is in the end more likely to work, because once the federal government starts mucking around in this stuff and makes a mistake, it's very difficult to fix it. And so allowing variation at the state level, more options to proceed, tied to accountability for results but not accountability for process, is the better way to go, in my view.
So that's, I'd call that radically different than what the administration is proposing.
In terms of the means, but not the ends. I think we very much agree
right.
on that.
Yes. No, I know. Yeah. But,
I would say, you know, we do need to have accountability for results, and I agree with that. And, you heard our secretary say, and this is his mantra across the panoply of programs that we administer, tight on goals and loose on means. You know, as I said earlier, we don't want a one-size-fits-all approach here, because we have a diversity in approach across the states that we feel is informative and important, and our approach here and our perspective is to be an accelerant with the states in reaching additional children and bringing them into a level of high-quality service. I think we need to be focused on results, but we would require monitoring of programs closely, but we need to have some guideposts along the way there that make sure that our investment is not a block grant. We have a block grant in early childhood education. It's a child care block grant, and we're not reaching the number of children we need with that block grant, and we're also not, we're struggling, you know, at $1 billion a year in investment there in raising the quality of that system. So, and so we believe we need to strike an appropriate balance here of codifying the right standards that we know research and science has shown is highly correlated to quality environments for children, but providing flexibility in terms of how to implement those standards and focusing on the outcomes, particularly at that kindergarten entry point.
So, Linda, you're going to run this if it passes? They're going to send you all this money? Does it sound good to you?
It sounds good to me. Anytime you give
money. What about the standards?
The standards are going to be a problem, and I know that they're going to be. I don't think any program is worth its weight if it doesn't have some sort of standard. But it's going to be a push. We're going to get pushback from providers. We know that, and that's traditionally been what happens when you try to raise quality standards. They argue then that their costs are going to go up. We've had a five-year plan for lowering the child-to-staff ratio in child care centers, and we're doing it in like five little rungs. Well, we got to rung three, and we've been stalled there for 3 years. So, it really is going to be a problem. But
I should say South Carolina's preschool program, which is a partnership between education and human services, and talking about looking at it from the ground up, people say, well, education does this and human services does that. And I've been there. The kids are in the human services and the education program are sitting on the same carpet square.
Indeed.
In the same classroom.
Right.
They're not really different.
No.
That program would meet all of the requirements except perhaps for the one on teacher salary, and I don't know the answer to that.
No, I don't know either.
But on all of the other standards, your state already has in place.
So let's draw a very quick parallel to Race to the Top, where the administration set some requirements, and some states had to change their laws to meet the requirements. I saw something recently that estimated that only a very small number of states today would meet what the administration is requiring to get their share of the money. So they're going to have to do some things before they can qualify for the money. First, do you agree with that? And then secondly, is that a good way to go? Say yes.
well, listen, so, this is race that we believe strongly in Race to the Top. I mean, we designed this program, 19 criteria. We now have, and we scored states based on their, not only what they applied for, but also their demonstrated commitment to these criteria. We had teams come in to Washington, D.C., of state commissioners and folk and educators from around the state to say, we agree, and this is the plan we're putting forward for Race to the Top. So we're excited about Race to the Top. Race to the Top Early Learning, we're in 14 states. We're trying to develop and build a system that's focused on quality and outcomes and a results-oriented approach to reform in early childhood education. So we're going to continue with that approach. We believe it's the right thing to do. This is different than that. You know, this is about providing, beginning with our children at 200% of poverty, but moving across to our middle-income families, providing a universal level of access to high-quality preschool. And we believe that we have a responsibility as a country to do that, not just in 14 states, but across all 50 states. You know, we'd expect we'd have about a third of states that would be ready to come into the program were Congress to enact it this year, and then another third in the next year and further going forward. And we want to work with states. This is why the bar for entry is not nearly as high as Race to the Top or as involved in terms of a competition. But moving forward, we do want to see some assurances from states around some of the standards that I mentioned.
Yeah, so just to, because I want to, I don't know that that would be clear to everyone. My understanding is what that means is states don't have to have all this stuff in place.
That's absolutely right.
To get started taking the federal money. They have to have goals to reach these.
And a trajectory to reach that,
yeah, exactly.
Right? So the question is for South Carolina and for other states. And, you know, the good thing is, you know, Steve has a yearbook and Nir has a yearbook that actually maps some of the states according to these standards. So if you're curious about where your state is, you should go and look at that yearbook.
So
but there's time to get there, right? And I think that's an important point as well. You know, you don't want to say overnight you have to implement, you know, these types of salary standards, for instance, because that takes time for states to be able to adjust and work with.
So let's have some good questions right here. Dr. Craig Ramey.
Thank you, Ron. This has been a wonderful seminar in the complexity of the development of human competence. And I'm happy to see that we might put health and human services and education into some arrangement where they are talking to one another. It strikes me that the policy issues always get chipped off and dealt with without much thoughtful connection to what is the fundamental building block of our society, which I believe is families. And getting the House to support this legislation, I think, is going to be a difficult chore. But it strikes me that one area that this is dealing with, the gradient that Steve described, which is we have underestimated the steepness of that gradient for generations, that if we saw these programs as family-strengthening mechanisms, some of which are aimed toward preschool children, some of which are aimed to help people move into the paid labor force, but it's the family as a whole that stands to benefit, and we know from research the intergenerational benefits that accrue in part as a result of some of these early services. If not family strengthening, the question is, where do you perceive there is likely to be a conceptual grounding point that will allow the Democrats and the Republicans to say grace over this bill?
Good question, Craig. You know, I think you point out the importance of strengthening families and parents, and we know that that's critical, particularly in these early years. I think a lot of the evidence of success of our home visiting efforts, for instance, speak directly to that fact. So I think there's a lot in this proposal and in this initiative that speaks to that piece. There's also a strong return on investment. I mean, there's a reason governors across both sides of the aisle, you know, regardless of their stripe, have invested in this reform in their states. And it's because it pays a return on investment. We know that. But ultimately, our ability to move this forward in Congress, we are going to appeal to the interests in Congress of of all of the benefits of this work on a policy basis. But ultimately, I think it hinges on what happens at the local level. You know, today we received a letter from over 300 business leaders and military leaders from across the country that support early education and support greater investment in early education and in home visitation. We know that there's support at the local level, you know, from business leaders, from folks in the military, from our education corners, from local municipalities who've passed bond measures to deliver this type of pre-K opportunity in their respective communities. So it's those voices that are going to compel Congress to act.
Well, guess what? There's a test right now. There's no question this is the time. There's not going to be another proposal like this in our lifetime. And if these business groups and military leaders and so forth are really committed, they'd better get to work in the House pretty damn quick. Next question. Here on the aisle.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for hosting this, Ron, and this wonderful panel on the panel before. I'm Adele Robinson from NAEYC, and this is a question for Roberto. And it's something that Dr. Owens and Dr. Barnett touched on, but we didn't really explore, which is, and I want to start with, NAEYC is in favor of standards. We are a standard setter for high-quality conditions for learning and for teacher preparation standards across BA, AA, and the like. You touched on this field being very low-income and being very undereducated. So, Roberto, we are asking, in both the pre-K and the early Head Start Child Care Partnership, if we're really going to meet children where they're being served across all the settings and provide high quality, will the administration be favorable to using some of those funds to invest in the workforce, much like they did in New Jersey and Abbott, in the scholarships, the release time, the substitutes, and then the higher pay, so that we can both attract and retain those better teachers throughout the continuum?
The answer to that is yes, but I'd like other panelists to also reflect on this. But I think we touched on this earlier about the importance of the workforce. We're not going to get to quality if we don't make the investments we need in a preparation and continuous development of teachers and of our early educators, and make sure that we're also having a system in place. We can't rest that entire imperative on this pre-K proposal. You know, there are a set of dollars that states currently use that need to be leveraged toward that end too.
So let me ask the rest of the panel, what are your ideas about a better workforce, a better prepared teachers? Do they all need to have a BA? What should we do to upgrade the talent out there that's teaching the kids, Jenny?
Well, for one thing, I think these two questions are really related. So is, you know, I was trying to make the point earlier, somewhat to what you're talking about, that the workforce in many cases are the parents of the kids. Understand that we're not interested, I think, in a poor kids program, as has been said, but are the kids of many of the lowest income kids who will presumably be in these high quality programs. So I think connecting the workforce to those, thinking of the workforce as being connected to the children directly, not just as their caretakers, but actually as their, you know, as their parents, is critical. I also would hope, I'm not sitting where Roberto is, but I would hope that some of the flexibility would be in that area. So I think this question of parameters, standards, and flexibility will really demonstrate whether South Carolina, for example, could choose. You mentioned teacher salary is an area of question that you're not quite sure about. Whether the states would have flexibility in that area as well as some of the other areas of meeting standards.
We know a little bit about how to improve the skills and effectiveness of preschool teachers. And there are interventions out there that work. They typically focus on particular skill sets, how to more effectively share a book with a young child or how to deal with behavioral problems in the classroom. And I think certainly that's the place to start. There has to be funding for those kind of professional development activities. We also have pretty good research that shows that a BA degree is not a predictor of effectiveness in the classroom. And we also know the general skill level is pretty low. And so an argument can be made that requiring the BA and paying at the teacher level at least assures a level of verbal skills that's probably higher than the typical workforce has today. But it's a very expensive way to get to that goal. I mean, the other reality here is as you drive up the cost, even if they are correlated with quality, you will at least at the outset drive down access. You know, a typical state pre-K program is spending maybe $3,000 a child, whereas K through 12 is $8,000 to. So you do the math.
Steve Abbott is 12.
No, I know that. I know that. Yeah. But I'm just saying the reality across the nation is that if you relatively rapidly ratchet up the cost of provision of the service, the provision will go down. And remember, this is the Obama administration has proposed a $75 billion federal investment, but it's a partnership with states. And over the 10-year plan, the state load exceeds the federal load. And so states will have to come into this thinking about what their costs are going to be and how they balance the cost against the need for quality, but also the need for access. All of those things are important. I mean, to the earlier question that Dr. Ramey had about the politics of all this, I would wonder, and this is maybe a question to Roberto, were there conversations in the, what would I want if I were a poor parent and needed preschool access? What I would want is a nice voucher from the federal government that I could spend at the preschool program my choice. It would not bother me if the voucher rate were tied to the quality of the preschool as rated by the state, but I'd like to be able to make that choice for myself, and it's a very different model from the top-down model we've heard here. Either it's the federal government top-down or the state's top-down. The parent has sort of left out of this, except as the recipient of wisdom from on high. So I think choice, vouchers, and good information on the quality of centers is another way to get to this that Republicans in the House would warm to considerably.
I would just
go ahead.
I was just going to say that choice needs to come with an awful lot of education for the parents, because I've seen in too many instances parents take their kids out of very high quality centers where the copayment is a little bit of money and put them with someone who has basically got six cots in a circle and you sit on it, because the copay is much less. So it really matters.
Because the parent can't make the copayment.
And they don't know the difference. They can't see immediately the difference in good childcare.
Well, then there's a total lack of information. If you're shopping for preschool services, and this is really across the range of educational levels of parents, you don't know what you're getting. I mean, you talk with other parents in the supermarket, you know, what is it like there? There's just an absence of information for one of the most important choices that a parent is going to make about his or her child. And this is certainly something the federal government could have a very active role in, is making information available to support parents in their choices they have to make.
Well, we can agree, Russ and I think, on the point of the parents needing greater access to information and greater information about the outcomes and the quality of their programs. You know, this is one of the driving elements behind our Race to the Top Early Learning Challenge, is to have states really establish rating systems around the entirety of their child care programs and other early learning programs, and provide parents clear, concise, understandable information about where their children are going, and so that they can make the decisions they need. That's important. But choice, I want to be clear, choice is not the driving principle of our pre-K program and preschool for all program. And it's not, because I think there's plenty of evidence that shows that the marketplace right now, particularly for our poor and vulnerable parents, does not, you know, choice is not delivering a high quality environment for their children. We just, you know, there's not a supply of high quality early learning for our children that's needed, particularly in our high poverty communities. So, you know, our approach is a bit different in that we want to make sure that there is, on a voluntary basis for the parents who want to take advantage of it, access to free, public, high-quality pre-K for their children. And you can't do that through a voucher program. I mean, we can't do that through a CCDBG child care block grant-like program.
Steve, you want to?
Yeah, I think the risk we have here in moving toward a compromise is that people will want to cheap out. And if we cheap out, we're going to end up spending money and not getting a return on our investment. putting in a highly qualified teacher probably adds in the neighborhood of $1,000 per child to the cost. That's nothing like what you lose by not having a good teacher in the classroom. BA isn't correlated with success as a teacher, in part because the loose standards for what constitutes a BA, and in part because there's lots of other things that can go wrong besides teacher qualification. But if you then ask the question, well, how many programs have produced these results that we're looking for with poorly paid teachers with lower qualifications, the answer is none. Right, so we don't have an example of where that model worked. So by all means, let's not do something that has not worked. And we have lots of examples of it not working. So why would we want to do that again? The voucher model, I think, has two weaknesses. One is that you have parents spending somebody else's money for, let's face it, part of the reason we're interested in doing this is because the benefits to the rest of us, not just for their kids. And they have no incentive from purely economic perspective to take those into account, when, in particular when they're spending somebody else's money. And then that there is, I think, a tendency to then underfund that with the implicit, the implicit in that is that higher income folks will essentially supplement that and they'll be okay. But poor people are the ones in Florida stuck with the $2,400 preschool voucher.
That's right.
So we got models of this. It's not just the child care voucher program, which may actually endanger kids. But we have examples of this in preschool.
You better not testify in the House and say that parent choice endangers kids, because they'll run you out of the place. One last question. Over here.
Good afternoon. My name is Almeda Keys, and I'm an executive director here in Washington, D.C. at the Edward C. Mazeek Parent Child Center, which is a Head Start, early Head Start program. And I've been hearing about the benefits and investments, and all of the dialogue has been very good. Thank you for inviting me. But I want to stand up today as an example of the investment and as an example of the return, because I'm a former Head Start parent. And I want to say that when you put the right supports in place for families, that families, and I can answer what families, what poor families want, because I was there. Families want to, first of all, believe that you're coming to them with a program that is real, that you really care, and that you're thinking about the comprehensive services that they need to address the needs of their children. Parents want their children to read. They want to work, they want to go to school, and they want to be empowered to go back and turn around their communities. Parents want to run for public office. They want to be able to be some of the decision makers at the table. And all of this can be done if we put the right supports in place. I stand in support of the president's proposal, and I just hope that we continue to strengthen the comprehensive services that we're offering to families. And when we think in terms of parent engagement or parent involvement, that we think about parent empowerment and parent engagement, and it's more than just reading stories to your children or being able to help them with their homework, but it's about going back into the local communities and making a difference in your local communities.
We're going to close on a statement, not a question, from the audience, but eloquently stated. I hope no one does that at our next event. Please join me in thanking the members of the panel, and good day.